Welcome, everybody. Welcome to the June 30th Expanded Budget Committee meeting for our first real examination of the 2021 budget. Thank you all for joining us. We know it's there's a lot of information to get to, and I just want to mention a couple things first before I turn it over to Jason. I know that a lot of our calculations, a lot of our, maybe I'll say hopes and dreams, are kind of waiting for the federal government to take action. From the various officials we're talking to, it seems that mid-July is now the target date for the next federal COVID bill to include whatever it is that they might include for state and federal, state and local governments. It's also, we should also be aware that even if money is included in a federal bill, it's not likely all of it would come in one bucket. There would probably be a couple or two or three tranches of funding. So there are a lot of details to consider. At tomorrow's meeting, 11:30 of the Tompkins Intergovernmental Relations Committee, we will hear more updates. Well, Amanda Spellacy from Senator Schumer's office will be on the call. Ryan Gregoire from NISAC is going to make a presentation. I've sent you his slides already. Just 40 slides, just a little bit of stuff to get through. But it's the latest information as of the end of session, so it'll be really good to have that. So even if we don't get through those slides, you have that in your inbox, which I haven't looked at myself yet. So as well as having Charlie Kazansky from Cornell on the call as well. So should be a good meeting, and I guess we'll get more, more information about the federal bill. Would also mention that Tom Reed is going to have his Thursday at, I think it's Thursday at noon, and Allison Hunt was sending out that invitation today. So one other slight little piece of information. I was, I'm on the Human Services Coalition board as a liaison. They had a meeting on Friday, and Kathy Slaughter, the whole team, went through the review of their agencies. And one of the a major takeaway was that the agencies in general are especially worried about 2021. For 2020, they have relatively good fund balances because of sales tax. That sales tax in 2019 did well. So they're actually kind of more worried about 2021 than they are about their current year. So that is one thing on their minds. The other is that a lot of the nonprofits have seen big spikes in fundraising and philanthropy on a short-term basis in response to this crisis. They're worried about whether the typical end-of-year donations will hold up, or were people kind of giving now instead of giving in December. So those are a couple of sort of things that they're worried about as they go forward. We'll hear more about that later, I'm sure. So with that, I just want to thank everybody for taking the time to come to this meeting today, and hand it over to County Administrator Jason Molino.
Thank you, Martha. Can everybody hear me okay? Good? Okay, thank you. I did briefly review the NISAC presentation that you sent out, Martha. It's good information. A lot of the statements and assumptions in there are very consistent with what we've been doing and in the presentation. So it was assuring, and we've been in communication with Dave Lucas and Ryan all along, but it's assuring that what they're talking about are a lot of the same thoughts and process we've put together with this PowerPoint. Before I get into it, I think to go back a little bit what you said, Martha, with Human Service Coalition, a portion of their funding is based on what's received in a prior year's sales tax. I actually think it's 2022, because I think it's a two-year delay where they get hit with what would happen in 2020. Nonetheless, it's an important, that could be countered with some recovery in that case. But nonetheless, there's a delay in it, and it's important to understand how that relationship works, because they get a portion of their funding from sales tax of a prior year, and then they get a portion of what you appropriate. And we can confirm that, too, and talk about what it looks like for them. So if you want, I did send out the PowerPoint just a second ago. It's updated from what I sent out Monday morning. I'm going to share the screen if that's all right.
Go right ahead.
All right. And let's try that again. Can everybody see that? So it should say 2021 budget review, yes?
It's good.
See that? I just moved the screen. Is it moving?
Yes.
All right, great. Okay. So what I did here is I thought it would be good to kind of recap a little bit of the 2020 year, what we've learned over the past 2 months since the last time we met at the beginning of May. Go in and see how things have updated, and there has been some updates just as of last week in terms of some EFMAP funding that we received. So that will act as a benefit for the year end 2020 because we'll make out with additional revenue that we didn't anticipate, and it will impact 2021. We're still trying to figure out how much it will impact us, but it will impact us in a positive because they did update some of the ACA EFMAP distribution. So I'll get into that.
Jason, excuse me. You're picking up a little, and you're not very loud. Are you – I don't know if actually there's a connection. Probably you might need to take your video off.
I could try speaking up a little bit more.
Yeah.
A little bit better.
Yeah. If it gets more spotty, we might ask you to take your video
off. Okay. I can do that, too.
Okay.
Thank you. Yeah. All right. Yeah, we'll try now. You don't need to see me. You just need to hear me. So tell me if it's not any better, and we'll go from there. But
that sounds better already.
All right, good. There you go. So you just got to take my picture off the screen. It gets better. I'll talk a little bit about what that means, that EFMAP funding. But we'll go for a brief overview of this year, what we're looking at for 2020. And then talk a little bit about what we know of 2021, and there's obviously a lot of variables that I think will impact that. But let's start. This was I want to reuse this slide again because I thought it was a good summary put out by the Division of Budget a few months ago when they started to capture the impact. The reason we're in this position right now is obviously because of COVID-19. Needless to say, there was a budget challenge for the state before, pre-COVID. If you remember, there was about a $6 billion deficit at that point in time that's only been exacerbated by the COVID-19 and the response related to it. I think one of the more important ones to talk about here is not much to talk about outside of we don't know how it's going to pan out, and that's after the fourth quarter. New York is suggesting that there'll be a slow recovery in the economy back to the first quarter of 2023. In terms of pre-COVID times. So that's a really a difficult thing to project. It's probably safe to say it's 2.5 years out. The truth is, with what's happening across the country now, surges across different states, that will definitely have a negative impact on us throughout this year and probably into next year as well. So while I think it's a positive and a hopeful outlook, it's still unknown whether or not the recovery is going to be that quick or it could be prolonged. A little bit of a mid-year review. This is just a summary of what I had talked about in May with respect to I'm just moving my screen right here, kind of a mild and severe scenario. So I used a mild and severe scenario because it's really still very difficult to project where numbers are going to lie. Some of the information we had, including NYSAC's financial update, did talk about a mild and severe scenario. So when we did this, let's say we'll look at a more of a mild and a more of a severe options because I just don't think it's practical at this point to try to narrow it down into a single small range. The mild scenario, revenue scenario, looked at a decrease in sales tax for the year of 15% and a reduction in state aid, where the severe scenario had a much larger reduction in sales tax and state aid, primarily those two because those are your two largest impacts on what would happen with your revenue. Interestingly, though, our first 2 months of sales projections have been fairly accurate on the mild side of things, which is good in terms of if we have to pick the best of worses out of this, being closer to the mild scenario is a better situation. What we have seen have been delays in state aid across the board with different agencies, different local governments, and the state is really, because they're experiencing some of their own liquidity issues, are withholding 20% of their state aid payments, and that's been consistent, and we'll talk more about that. But it's possible that there could be a permanent reduction in state aid around the 20% mark. And if that's the case, the numbers would be between the mild and severe scenario, depending on what it is and how much it impacts us. Nonetheless, a revenue shortfall between 11 and, you know, just under 18 million is what we're looking at right now. And I don't think that's changed a whole lot in terms of revenues. We'll know what our June revenue is going to look like in terms of sales tax. I'll forewarn you now, the first drawdown happened, and it's completely all over the board across the state. It's probably one of the – I didn't look at my email much today until about an hour before I got on, and there were emails flying left and right from administrators that their first drawdown ranged from a 40% decrease to a 100% increase for whatever reason. There's no real rhyme or reason right now. Rick had the same issue across treasurers, so we'll see how June pans out in the next week, week and a half. But so far, our April and May projections were along the models that we put together. And the model we put together was very similar in the way NYSAC kind of assessed their sales tax projections in their PowerPoint, which is reassuring again. I think they copied us, but anyway, ours came out before them. This is just a capture of some expenditure reductions. Hasn't changed much. This is about what we've captured so far. Vacant positions has increased a little bit. But for the most part, this was the initial effort, and I don't think it'll change much from this slide. We may increase it a little bit more depending on if we decide to do some additional agency contract reductions. If there are continued furloughs, this may increase a little bit in terms of total expenditure reductions. And here's a little bit of the revenues over expenditures. In May, we had an operating deficit of between 7 and 13.5 million. The difference here is that last week we did get some EFMAP funding. So EFMAP funding there was enhanced EFMAP funding through the COVID, due to the CARES Act. There was enhanced COVID funding, and we did receive some of that, about 80% of it, which was normal in the way they were distributing EFMAP funding even pre-COVID, and they would reconcile at the end of the year. And then also there was an update in the ACA EFMAP funding, if you remember correctly. This was aid that we were supposed to get from the federal government as part of revenue sharing with respect to ACA. Yes, Deborah?
Yeah, Jason, when I went to that NYSAC seminar on the last, or webinar on the last legislative session, and they said that the EFMAP funding was going to be distributed, quote unquote, as a reduction in the weekly payments.
Yes, it will be.
Will be reduced. What is this you're saying we actually got? Is that over and above the reduction?
No, this is I'm sorry. Let me explain it. This is the cumulative of what we think we will be on budget for 2020 as a result of the reduced weekly share payments between July and next to the end of the year. I just lumped it all together to show you the net benefit. The EFMAP funding isn't a check that they write to us. They distribute it through reduced weekly share payments. So I think our budget was around $12 million or so. The net benefit we will get this year under budget will be about $1.4 million. So I put it in simple terms so we could deal with larger numbers in terms of operating deficits. But you're correct. It will be received in a decrease in weekly share for Medicaid payments.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. It's not a check. It's not a lump sum check. The other thing this is just
this much, Jason. Right? You expect this much budget relief in 2020.
2020, based on what we were told in the letter that we sent, that I think some of you saw. Basically, I had Tom Herbin tell me how much will we come in under budget for 2020 based on the start of these payments in July, and. This was basically the decrease will come in under budget. So, in that essence, it's a decreased expense, so to speak. We are working on the coronavirus, the CARES Act aid for EFMAP will not continue for its totality in 2021, but there will be a reduction due to ACA changes in EFMAP funding for 2021. So we're going to work on that a little bit more and compute our 2021 budget, but we don't have that as part of this presentation. So some of it, you know, essentially there's a one-off benefit from that aid, which was, I think, was intended to do. So this is, you know, it's better, put it that way. I mean, it's a six, you know, it's a $5.6 million operating deficit and a $12.1 million operating deficit. That's a better circumstance than what we knew 2 months ago, which is good. Obviously not ideal, but better than a 7 and a 13.5. Additional actions to keep in mind that may change that. Keeping vacancies vacant, and that's what we're going to continue to do. I've continued with a flexible hiring freeze on vacant positions. At the beginning in May, we identified there were several positions we would be searching for, which was the resource commissioner and the chief equity and diversity officer. We're going to continue along that plan. There are a few other key positions that are continuing to be that continue to be searched or have an open search for. So we'll continue to try to keep as many positions vacant as possible. Now I'm working with department heads to identify if there are positions that are being proposed being eliminated as part of the proposed budget. And that may have to lead into a conversation about not recalling those employees and keeping them on furlough until the budget process ends, but keeping their health insurance intact. That could range between 15 to 20 employees, depending on the departments involved. And I had a call out to department heads late last week to have a conversation. So when I get back next week, we'll talk over with them about how to proceed versus, you know, we have a financial challenge this year with an operating deficit, and B, bring back employees just to advise them that the position might be, I think, posed to being eliminated could be difficult as well. So we're going to talk about possibly keeping those positions up on furlough, but keeping their health insurance intact till the end of the year. And then obviously something else to consider would be another fourth quarter reduction supporting agencies. A 25% reduction, again, would equal about $500,000. And this action, I would probably want to wait until mid-August to see if there is any federal stimulus that may come out of the year with that. Martha, you mentioned mid-July. I've heard mid-July. I've heard mid-August. Right now, we thought it was going to be mid-June. it's all over the board. So this decision can be postponed a little bit to kind of wait and see what happens, probably till mid-August, to see what happens with if there's a fourth stimulus package or not.
Jason, can I ask a question?
Yes, Dan.
Can you go back one slide, please? I didn't understand something. I waited as long as I could, and I still don't understand.
Sure, no problem.
I don't understand what this is showing us. For instance, May estimated operating deficit of what?
Your general fund.
For 1 month.
For one year.
And then in June, the June number is the estimate for the year.
Yes.
Which has now been reduced.
Correct. It's been updated because EFMAP 8 has come in.
Thank you.
Yes. I'm sorry, I didn't label a general fund. Oh, all right, general fund, right. Okay.
I just didn't. Okay, very good. Thank you.
No, I understand. On the right-hand side of this, I included just an updated in terms of vacant positions, hires. This has primarily been in DSS just due to the current staffing. Also, with DSS, a lot of the positions don't really impact in terms of us financially because a big portion of them are reimbursed. Separations, folks have been separated from service. Total vacancies, I just talked to Lisa about an hour ago. She said there's up to about 7 individuals that have given notification that they're going to take the retirement incentive. Again, total furloughs with the number that have returned as of 6/22. And again, if you remember, we did anywhere between 6 week to 12 week furloughs, depending on the department and the situation. Some of them were partial, and some of them were full time. But I'll give you a recap over the past 2 months as to where those positions are right now, and numbers have come back, and where we are with vacant positions. Other budget concerns. There's two slides here that I wanted to include. This is an update of the. What happened in May, remember there is a change in the 3730 restoration services. So this is a situation where an individual as arrested is not fit to stand trial, so they have to be hospitalized. In the prior years, the county shared this cost 50-50 with the state. With the adoption of this year's budget, it is now 100% a local share, meaning 100% covered by the county. This could be a $50,000 increase over the prior year. This would take effect for this year. Next year, we start to have a hit in sales tax, because of the association with a distressed hospital nursing home fund. The state is going to take off about $330,000 off the top of any sales tax we receive to put into this fund, capitalize this fund. That'll start in 2021 and possibly sunset in 2022. So I'm sure there'll be more discussion in later budgets about that.
Jason, that $350,000 for the 730 restoration, that was the number last year, I believe. That was the increase we projected last year. Do you know if that's kind of looking like that would be the actual increase for 2020?
This is around what we spent last year. So if I just double it because we're paying another 50%, that's how much it would increase, another $350,000.
Is it impacted by our smaller inmate population?
This is a difficult one because these are individuals that have to be hospitalized because they're not fit for trial. So it fits into a different category. This is probably a better conversation to have with Frank about the circumstances of these individuals.
Okay. Thank you.
On the increased revenue decrease side, we have some answer with respect to EFMAP funding, which is good. This is part of the stimulus. We received that, and we'll continue to receive it over the next few months. One thing that this letter wasn't clear on is that it wasn't clear if the state granted us our reconciliation of EFMAP funding over the past 3 years. So I know an ISAC was looking into that as of last week. Ryan may have some updated information for tomorrow. I would imagine if that was to be the case, they would have told us by now. But there is still this question about reconciliation over the past 3 years of EFMAP funding. So what would generally happen is the state would forward you reduced payments, basically your weekly shares, but it would account for about 80% of what was expected, and then year end they would reconcile that other 20%, and then that would usually be cut by a check. But that hasn't happened for 3 years, so there's still kind of this potential reconciliation that's hanging out there for EFMAP funding for the past. And then the original, I think it was 257 in COFA funding, is actually 228 now. And this is clarity that we were able to get on this, is this has to be with COVID-related expenses only. So we can't offset our operating budget. It's really for additional costs related to the aging expenses. And as of now, we don't have guidance as to how that money can be used specifically. So we'll be on standby for that. But that could help if there were additional expenses related to COVID this year. A few other concerns that I think are worth just mentioning so you're aware of it, because I think if we didn't discuss them in one way or another, it could impact the county. One is TC3, so at the Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee meeting, maybe last month it was, Martha, I don't remember. It was one of the months. It was within the past few weeks. TC3 gave a presentation. Oh, actually, it was a meeting with them in Cortland County.
Right, that's right.
TC3 gave a presentation on their financial position. At that point in time, there was a lot of talk and discussion about an uncertainty as to whether or not they would get a quarterly aid payment, which is about $2.6 million around June 20th. They did get the payment that following week, which was last week, and it was for 80% of the 2.6, which is 2.1. And this was confirmed, and I was actually able to ask this of Budget Director Mojica, specifically asking if this was going to be the case. He confirmed, yes, it was. It would be processed shortly. It was processed within a few days later. And that he confirmed the state is having liquidity problems and that they're going to be making delayed or reduced payments across the board in a lot of different areas of about 80% for the primary reason that they want to withhold 20, that if there is no federal relief, they'll reduce that state aid payment by another 20%. So the 20% number seems to be a reasonable number to focus on when we talk about reductions in state aid, and that was confirmed by the Budget Director Malika. So I don't know that it gets any better source than that. Frankly, good thing is that the TC3 did receive that $2.1 million, so there's no immediate cash flow needs. Conversation with their CFO last week prior to leaving as I was preparing for this meeting tonight. We went over some of the cash flow projections. And in all circumstances, there isn't any immediate need from cash flow needs. Cash flow becomes constrained again towards the fall, which is usually when tuition kicks in. So this may be a conversation to revisit in another 3 or 4 months, but they seem fairly comfortable that as long as state aid continues to come in, even if it's reduced to 80%, they'll still be able to meet their cash needs. That said, I will tell you they're on a 90-day accounts payable cycle. So they're not paying their bills every 30 days. They're paying every 90 days. So that again, is another indication of constrained cash. The only way to come out of that, frankly, is to limit or mitigate expenses and to increase your revenue, which has to be through tuition fees of some sort or tuition. Tuition. That's really the only way they're going to slowly grow out of that cash flow challenge. Also in that budget discussion with TC3, they talked about several requests. There was 150,000 of deferred maintenance requests for this year and then $300,000 deferred maintenance for next year. And then also the potential of $600,000 of aid from counties with respect to state aid becomes permanent in terms of the reduction becomes a permanent reduction of 20%. They are going to need some support from Tompkins and Cortland County. So what that means is the 2020 budget will be submitted to budget capital personnel for this month, and then mail the budget, assuming their state aid is intact. State aid is reduced, let's say by 20%, they will need to use about $1 million of their existing fund balance, which is just about to balance the budget, and most likely need support from Tompkins and Cortland, at least in the immediate future, to get through some of the constraints that they're going to have. Because if you keep in mind, they already have been reduced in some aid based on the 2021 state budget. So right now, their budget's going to come to the legislature for adoption without an increase in local shares. But they are making a request of a one-time increase in local share with this deferred maintenance cost. And if there is further reduction in state aid, there may be an additional need for local support.
All right, Jason, I see a couple hands. And first, I can ask, so both that $500,000 and $600,000, those would be times two-thirds would be our share of that?
Essentially.
Okay. So Cortland picks up a third of it, and we pick up two-thirds. Anne and then Shauna.
Yeah, I first question, maybe there's been an update that I missed, but last presentation I had, they didn't have $1 million of fund balance. So I'm trying to understand what that would be coming from. That's my first main question.
They'll have $1 million of fund balance after the current fiscal year. They'll have about 1.1.
So they'll have to use their entire fund balance. And if I recall, a state of health was that they had a 5% budget in reserve in fund balance.
I think they'll have to use their fund balance if they have a further reduction in state aid. If they don't have a further reduction in state aid, then I don't think they'll need to tap into their fund balance.
And we usually, at the end of the year, we do an advance for their payroll. I'm assuming that would still be.
Right. We do an advance for them. We, we've done two things as of recent. One, we advance them their upcoming year's payments early. Usually in the prior, just at the end of the prior year. And again, that speaks to a cash flow constraint. And the other thing we've done along with Cortland County is we've re-amortized their debt, which again speaks to a cash flow constraint. So you've done two actions already to help assist with this. But, if state aid continues to get cut, it's going to be a problem for them, an ultimate problem for us.
The last question, when do they have any indication of when they might know, or is this part of the whole state package of July or August when we'll find out about state cuts?
I think it's all tied in, to be honest with you. Okay. I think it's all tied in right now in terms of the state and the government are waiting to see what happens federally. That's going to be a big part of it.
All right. Thank you, Jason.
Yep.
Shauna?
Hi, I was just wondering, as far as TC3 is concerned, I know that we're doing furloughs. We're talking about some people not returning. It doesn't seem fair that we would fund them and then perhaps have to cut some of our own people. Have there been cuts at TC3?
Yes, they have furloughed employees, and I know they've reduced and eliminated positions. I don't have the exact number, but I can definitely get that if you'd like it.
Thank you.
All right, thanks. Jason, are you okay with questions like this, or do you want to just roll
through? It's fine with me. However you want to work it, Martha. I'm okay with it either way. Yep.
Okay. All right, great. I mean, let's try not to, like, debate during this, but questions to clarify the information are certainly sure. Thanks.
Sure. Okay, I'll move on. TCAT received, we received funding for aid for TCAT through the CARES Act, for the first and second CARES Act. We used for reimbursable eligible expenses. And it, I believe there's a resolution coming in front of HED to accept that funding. It's really to support expenses that aren't going to be supported due to lost revenue. As you know, ridership is down. The TCAT continues to be down. They have to restrict the amount of folks they can have on bus. So I imagine it will continue to be down through this year and probably well into next year as well. This is aid to help support their operation, really, from lost revenue. I have had conversations with Dwight as well as Scott preliminarily about, you know, understanding as they're learning as they're going with respect to projecting forward as to what they think the revenue shortfall is going to be. This is really aid meant to support public transportation. And also just another example of the state aid payments. There's still a payments for the first quarter was not received yet, at least as of last week. I haven't touched base with Scott this week, but as of last week, still wasn't received. Deborah?
Yeah, thank you. So I'm a little confused because my understanding from what we've heard at TCAT meetings is that the counties receive this money, but the county will determine how it will be apportioned among TCAT, Gadabout, any other transit-related organizations, and the county itself. So I'm not sure that it is it entirely accurate to say the whole $9.27
million? No, you're correct. So in that HED resolution, there's allotments for, it's primarily for TCAT and Gadabout. There's also some other costs related to transportation with respect to COVID that would be covered. So, for example, a lot of the transportation costs for folks that had barriers of transportation to getting to and from the testing site, some of this aid would be going into there to covering that. So you're right, Deborah, it's a much broader scheme. It's really public transportation as a whole. Primary recipients are TCAT and Gadabout. But there are other transportation costs that fit under that realm. I don't know all the details to it, but I know we'll be able to talk more about it at HED.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's correct.
Mike Lane?
Jason, how much is that STOA payment that they didn't get?
Oh, I don't know that. Deborah, you might. I don't have it off the top of my head. I'm sorry.
All right.
Well, TCAT doesn't know either, Mike, because in a situation like this one where ridership has dropped off so drastically, the state can have this hold harmless thing that they do, which instead of using this year's actual ridership numbers, they base your STOA for this year on your ridership last year. And we had hoped that would happen, but we don't know. We haven't heard anything. We were supposed to learn in May, and I suspect now, this is just another example of the state withholding payments and not letting us know how much we could get until they find out if the federal government's going to help us out at all.
That's why I included the sidebar there. You know, there's some commonality with these folks, with these two entities getting state aid. It's just being withheld or deferred or partially paid. I can find out what it was last year and let you know what the first quarter was last year, what the expected would be, but there's more detail. There's no nuances, Deborah said, to it with round ridership and also revenue and how it's earned, but I can get you a rough estimate as to what it was expected to be.
Thank you.
Yep, no problem. Lastly, we received about $1.78 million through the CARES Act for the airport to assist aid really in supporting revenues that other weren't received or supporting expenses through the airport. This can be used for operations as is capital. So, Mike and I have talked about this at both F&I, I think, and budget capital personnel. And, you know, we'll wait to see how the year end comes out with 2020 to determine if we're going to apply that. also the nice thing is nice thing, but yeah, the element of the CARES Act funding, it can be applied for both 2020 as well as 2021. So there may be a reason to apply some of that to the 2021 budget, but there's expected to be a continued shortfall in revenue in both areas, in transportation, both bus and air travel. So the reason I wanted to include both of these was for the primary, all three of these, is that, you know, these are, you know, areas impact the county one way or another, or could impact the county one way or another. Thought it'd be important for you all to understand where some of the you know, revenue is coming from, or where some of the shortfalls may be coming from.
Jason,
yes, sir.
I have a first quarter STOA application here. I can tell you the amount: $1.2 million.
Great. Okay, so it was expected to be $1.2 million. It looks like also, if I remember, Drew just sent. Chad, it looks like in May of 19, they got 913,000. So you're between the 900 and 1.2 million mark.
Yes, they actually do the whole harmless.
Yeah, right.
One of the things we're hearing from NPTA is that they're going to take at least a 30% reduction on the STOA payments. So we simply don't know.
Yep. Yeah. Again, I think this is going to fall again. Like a lot of this is on the federal aid if it happens or not. Any questions on this before I go to the next slide? I thought it was important to bring it up because, you know, there's some large dollars here, and it's good to get that aid, but you should be aware of it. Uncertainty, again, this is a slide I had at the last PowerPoint. I thought it was important because it put some reminders in everyone's mind about what's going on. You know, the short-term impacts, yes, the economy, you know, deteriorated rapidly, primarily because it was shut down. The time of restart, this is a little bit of a balance that we don't really know. I mean, we paid for, which is good. There are definitely a lot of elements that are not yet open as part of phase four, or there are sectors that are partially open, even though they were part of a prior sector. We don't have a necessarily end date as to when, you know, we'll be fully open again, and you may not for quite a few months. Could be longer. Obviously, with everything going around us in the country in terms of surges in other states, that will impact us one way or another. And that also has to do with what areas recover and what sectors recover quicker than others, how they open up and operate again. And then lastly, just additional waves. Obviously, the pandemic itself, we could be in for a resurgence ourselves in the next few months. Hopefully not, but just the so all of these things create an unnerving and anxious approach to budgeting because there's no certainty, which is when we like to have certainty of anything. It just adds for a very difficult – it makes for a very difficult time to give you set numbers and with any consistency in reliability. So on that note, let's look in the 2021 budget. So what we tried to do here, Kevin and I, we tried to put it in a format that you're most familiar with, and that's how we would normally go through a budget retreat process, looking at major drivers, kind of maintenance of effort versus a beyond maintenance of effort, to kind of take revenue projections for what we know today and then put in what we think we know with respect to certain expenses of what might be for next year. Now, there is a lot of unknowns, more so than most in most years, and I'll go through those. But it kind of gives us the beginning, or at least the baseline of something to talk about, or at least to think about as we go into the next few months. So here's a maintenance of effort discussion. You know, we went through salary fringes. We looked at capital. Again, increasing capital like we have. That's, I think, going to be a point of discussion come budget time as well. Plowing, usually know, just some human service updates. Let me stop for a second. I'll just remember, parentheses is good. No parentheses is bad. Parentheses means it's a decreased cost. No parentheses means an increased cost. Sales tax, again, increased cost. I think we're going to be under what we were budgeted for this year, and then other drivers. So if I take all of this right here, and in terms of this maintenance of effort, it's equal roughly an increase of about $11.5 million on the levy, which is about a 22.5% increase on the tax levy, right? Other drivers, usually this is a little bit more exhaustive of a slide, but there are primary additional drivers here, unallocated revenues, series of different revenues we think that are going to come in short compared to the current year, and then doer contribution. There's a grant that we get we're slowly getting out of our operational support and really going into capital support and door improvements. So, for example, the microwave upgrade is being paid for through rent on an annual basis.
Jason, go back. You said the unallocated revenue is what? Where is that coming
from? It's a variety of different revenues. So it could be casino money, could be clerk's fees, mortgage tax, a lot of, it's, you know, it's a bunch of amalgamation of revenues we kind of go through and give some rough projections on.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, beyond maintenance of effort. So this is generally your supporting agencies. The direction we gave was a 12% decrease. That was across the board to all our departments as well as supporting agencies. Talk about a little bit in a while where we came with up with that number, but if we were to decrease supporting agencies 12% from the 2020 target, including TCAD agreement, because that's considered a supporting agency, I left TCAT and TC3 flat for the time being. I didn't get into those issues, but when you take those and you combine them all, it's about a decrease of 860,000 combined. Taking maintenance effort and beyond maintenance of effort, you have a just shy of of $11 million levy increase, about a 21% tax levy increase if you make it all up through a tax levy increase. Okay, not practical in terms of making up the shortfall through a total tax levy increase. So what we did with this is we said, well, what would happen if we add all basically departments, cut their local funding, their local dollars by 12% reduction. And that was basically across the board. So when we gave direction, when I gave direction to department heads, I actually had them complete the flat budget and the 12% reduction budget to understand as part of a starting point for discussion. You take out another $5 million worth of expense, you come down to about a total levy increase of about $5.35 million, which is still about a 10%, well, a 10.5% levy increase. Just to put it in real terms, it equals about a $125 annual increase in property taxes, $190,000 home. The right hand side here, there's six bullet points that I think are important to understand because they don't necessarily take into consideration, you know, this $5.5 million or this 10% tax levy increase doesn't take into consideration these other factors. So the current retiree health care factors, so the changes that were made with retiree health care have not yet been factored into some savings that we'll see compared to this number. So that has to be taken into consideration. Recovery, again, we're using some very broad broad sectors and categories, and we're looking at economic recovery hopefully in another month and a half. We'll have certainly be able to narrow that down a little bit or at least have a better understanding of what may or may not happen. Program, I think we're going to have to review and revamp the capital program to understand prioritization of projects, how much we're annually appropriating for capital, understand how much we want to invest and how that impacts the tax levy increase. Staffing and other reductions, part of the process I'm about to go through over the next month and a half is meeting department heads as what they've submitted with expected vacancies, elimination of vacancies, or elimination of positions. But that's yet to be determined, and that could obviously change this number. The EFMAP reconciliation, we're going to understand what the impact would be for 2021. That has not been factored in here. Conversely, state aid reductions. I don't know what state aid reductions could be for this year or for next year, so it could be bad in terms of, you know, negatively impacting this number. Point being is there's a lot of unknown factors. This is a starting point, at least a discussion point, kind of give you a snapshot. The governor comes out with, you know, significant state aid cuts tomorrow, it could change this discussion for the worse. And the economy could recover better than expected in the fall, and they could change it for the better. I don't know the answer to that question, but I think there are several things you should know as we go into the process that could change the outcome of this right here.
Okay, I've got Anna's hand.
Sure.
Yeah, Jason, thank you so much for this. One of the things that I'm thinking, I think this is one of those times where it would be wonderful to have the public see this so that they understand the breakdown and, you know, we can all be on the same page. And there are some acronyms that people may not understand. I was hoping you might give, I mean, we know it, the EFMAP,
sure,
but give a 1 second, you know, what is EFMAP for those who are watching?
Federal,
you know, as if that's possible.
Medicaid. it's related to Medicaid aid. I think federal Medicaid, I can get it for you. I'm sorry.
It's not that. I'm not asking for the acronym, simply just what it is, which is, it's not super straightforward, but that would be great.
No, sure. So the FMAP reconciliation is obviously would be a benefit to the county because it would show an increase in aid to the county, which would result in a decrease of weekly payments to the state.
Right, because we pay part of Medicaid.
Yes.
The federal government reimburses, but the state doesn't necessarily give us all.
Right. So in New York State, the good Medicaid challenge and discussion is that state shares part of the Medicaid costs of this federally and state mandated program with the localities. Until recently, there was a greater share. It is capped around $12 million a year for us. EFMAP aid could mean that $12 million could decrease on annual basis.
Right, so we overpay, and at the end of the year, we're supposed to get reconciled. Yep. That's all. Yep. Yeah, I just wanted to make sure people knew.
Yep, good points. I'll move to the next one.
Sir. Yeah, Jason, just to say, so in other words, that last bullet seems like the really big hammer that could fall. Like
this one? State aid?
State aid, like even without any cuts that might be coming from the state, we're looking at a 2.5% levy increase, roughly.
So this assumes a 15% cut in state aid.
Okay. Okay.
Actually, let me, this does not. I'm sorry, this does not assume that. I apologize. I got my slides mixed up. This does not assume that. This does not assume. So, yes, you're correct. If there is more state aid reductions, this picture could get, it will be negative. It will impact us negatively. I'm sorry.
Okay. So this is the best case scenario.
Right now, with what we know, like I said, there are some good things over here that will impact this positively. Ones that haven't been factored in here, but these are things that we're going to work on the next month and a half to help bring this number, down and improve upon. But the last one there, the state aid reduction, if we get hit with a 20%+ reduction in certain state aid, that's going to be a challenge for sure. And EFMAP stands for Enhanced Federal Medical Assistance Percentage.
Thanks, Jason.
Yep. Assumption of the tax cap. So you put that funky slide in here that reminds you all how easy the tax cap is to calculate. I spared you, but we did a preliminary number. Kevin did a preliminary number with our tax cap estimate. This will change. But right now, the tax cap is about 3.74%, so about $4.9 million you could increase on the levy and state under the tax cap. Obviously, that's less than, $0.35 million increase. So if you were to adopt this, it would require an override in the tax cap.
Jason, do you know, in these various calculations, have you identified how much, what penalties we would see going over the cap?
So there's really one primary penalty, and that's related to the raise the age reimbursement. We haven't had a lot of raise the age reimbursement, I want to say under $100,000 in this case. And there's actually a way to appeal it if you're fiscally distressed.
Okay.
Appeal process, which we would appeal for and appeal to, as I would imagine probably any county that would do an override would. So an element for an appeal process to ensure that you're not penalized for it. And if you remember, the last attempt that didn't pass through this executive budget was to penalize us through, increased Medicaid payments. That wasn't adopted with this executive budget. But that would have been, if that was the case, we would have really had some challenges.
Okay, the great news then, we could probably win that fiscally challenged.
I think everybody could right now if this happens to come the way it is now, yeah. So an avenue to plead your case and basically request from the Division of Budget that, we have a fiscally distressed and are entitled, we shouldn't receive that aid.
Okay.
Yeah, I realized that we could easily make a good case for being fiscally distressed, as could almost every county in the state, but I'm wondering, as a political matter, how likely it is that the state would allow us to do that. What do you think?
I mean, I don't think the state is going to, you know, they're not going to, you know, say hit the pause button on the state, on the tax cap. You know, they're not going to, that was pretty clear early on that there was no chance the state is going to say, you know, we're going to allow overrides, you know, without any process. You know, the state can't neglect the fact that if they cut aid significantly and they put all these huge other costs, they can't deny the fact that they've been a driver of this. So, you know, it's not a public process, the appeal itself. You know, it's a paperwork exercise that we go through and that I file when we file for reimbursement. Why they would do it or why they would deny it, obviously we can. And if we get to that point, you know, we'll have the discussion as to whether or not we should. It's hard to believe that the state would take that hard approach. I mean, they create a process for this exact circumstance, similar circumstance, and they don't authorize, you know, they don't use it. You know, I wouldn't put it past them, but it really, if they want to throw us a bone, they could do it.
So if we want to avoid that whole thing, we would have to find a way to cut the budget further or use fund balance to make up for, what, $8.5 million, which is the difference between the 10.43 on your last slide and the 1.9 on this one. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, for $100,000 worth of aid, I would say forget it. Override. I mean, to cut millions of dollars out of your budget to save $100,000 is probably not worth it.
Yeah, I was just asking the question because I wasn't sure. I knew about the age. I wasn't sure if there were any other hidden penalties, you know, hiding or lurking somewhere. But if that's all there is, like, okay, it's not something to worry about.
Yeah. So this will change. The tax cap will change, but it's a good understanding of where we are with things. So I threw this in here as well. Discussion. Again, I want to emphasize this is a snapshot of right now, having, you know, 2019 closed for sure, and I know Rick's working on the financial statements, but this is looking at basically the statements as of the fund balance statement as of the end of 2018, what was expected in terms of your adopted OTRs. Now, that is a little bit lower, your one-time adopted OTR, because it's been cut a little bit through this process, maybe $300,000 or so. Rollover, there's some appropriated fund balance, and then the transfer into the capital fund, which was part of the adopted budget, which was to transfer $2.5 million for fund balance into the capital fund to support the capital program. If all of that happens and you take a mild scenario versus a severe scenario, you can see where your percentages fall and your fund balance lies in this. I want to say this is, you know, premature and preliminary, but it gives a bit of substance to think about. Rick and I, just before COVID started, were about to bring forward the fund balance policy, and then everything happened at the end of February, and it got postponed further. But basically what we were going to recommend was an unassigned fund balance range of about 18% to 23%, and that's a safe range to be in. A range is also preferable in that this is never a set, you know, the second it's set in terms of you know, it's never a set target in terms of, it's never going to stand still. It's always moving in terms of fund balance. So the change was a good way of capturing. We were starting to see that a little bit more in fund balance policies. And that range was about 18 to 23%. We thought that was safe. That would help maintain a good, stable, within that, a good, stable bond rating. Another thing to consider is that this does assume a transfer of $2.5 million to the capital fund like we originally discussed with the capital program. That may have to be reconsidered. We have not transferred that money because that would be done through a separate resolution. We haven't transferred that money into the capital program and capital fund yet, but as Mr. Bolt says, you know, reviewing the capital program and timing of projects and the amount of investment will have to be part of this budget evaluation as we go through. But, you know, this helps to understand what happens have an operating deficit. It, you know, basically takes away from your fund balance. Not a black and white picture. There's other things to be considered, but for the most part, I think this is about as focused of an effort we can make right now with what we know. Neither of them are great situations, but, you know, the positive thing is that you do have a good fund balance. You have a healthy fund balance. If we take the transfer of $2.5 million out, it would bring you more around a 60% for the mild scenario, which would be close to the bottom end of our range, which is still positive. Some fund balance growth is expected from 2019, which again will improve this situation, but it just gives you an example of what, you know, what it could look like. And from there, obviously in a more severe scenario, you know, it's not a position we want to be in, but you have the fund balance to be able to cushion the situation.
Jason, remind us that transfer to the capital fund, was that for the green initiative?
It was just in general to support a lot of initials in the capital fund because it, you know, the capital projects fall at different times throughout the course of the next 5 to 20 years, and we cash flow kind of a cap demand analysis based on when it would dip on certain debt being taken on. So an infusion of $2.5 million would really support some of the cash for capital projects versus when certain debt came in. You know, that we're going to have to revamp all of that and redo it all again to determine what projects, you know, are manageable moving forward and what's the time frame for some of them to kind of give you an understanding of you know, where you might want to work on some of these things. So,
okay. Anna?
Thanks. Another question about fund balance. Part of the reason that we try and keep the fund balance between 18 and 23 is because it puts us at a Moody's rating that gets us at the lowest bond rating for any bonds, percentage-wise. So, Rick, do you have any input on what the impact would be of going down to the 14% or even, God forbid, the, you know, 11.5%?
No, we had this conversation, I think, the last legislative meeting or the one before, where there are so many factors besides just the level of fund balance, demographics, population, a whole lot of things out of our control, that it's just one of the elements that Moody's looks at. So as we continue to use fund balance over time, if it goes down in a negative manner over too long a period of time, that would raise a flag with them. But just a one-time use, especially during an emergency like this, I would imagine everybody's going to be showing financial over the next 3 to 5 years that looks pretty sorry compared to their fund balance, because everybody's going to be using up their fund balance to some degree. I don't think it's going to have that bad an effect. On the good news, we just sold bands today for the airport, that $3 million band, and we came in at a 0.85%.
Wow. So what you're saying is part of the mathematical estimation is if we're low, but year over year we are increasing, that they take into consideration.
Yeah, they look at trends.
Okay.
And they saw our trend over a 10-year period is steadily growing. And we can show a trend over the next 4 or 5 years of decreasing the fund balance. But with that comes a plan of why we're using it. That it is our own in-house self-financing scheme, if you want to call it that, that they look favorably on that because we have a planned use of fund balance for one-time or capital projects, which would put us in a favorable light.
As long as we're not using it for operating expenses.
Right. You know, with the exception of an emergency year like this, because every government is going to be evaluated on a level playing field, and every government is going to be using some severe use of fund balance for operating purposes during a COVID-19 or any other emergency situation like this.
Great. Thanks.
And in any case, borrowing costs are, as you just reported for today, borrowing costs are historically low.
True.
And likely to stay there. Okay, thanks very much.
Mm-hmm. So, again, I'll just echo an important piece will be as we recover, you know, continuing to build, you know, our financial resources, build from whatever we utilize due to this, you know, situation will be an important piece as to whether or not your bond rating slips or decreases. And also probably the local economy will impact that too. The local economy continues to grow, even if it's slowly over time, and recovers, that's going to add value to our bond rating. But this is a snapshot of what it could look like. And again, the positive of it is that you have a fund balance to absorb some of these circumstances, which a lot of people really don't. A lot of communities. So factors impacting the county's future, the economy, I put this question mark to it because I just don't know, you know, what the recovery is. I don't think anybody does. You know, we're hopeful that we'll really start to see the economy start to grow come the beginning of the year, the beginning of the first quarter of 2021. But as we all know, a lot of things could change that or could slow that. Fund use again, what are we going to use this year will impact us. New York State and Fed mandates, again, cut in state aid. You know, that's going to be a big factor as to what's going to happen. Our infrastructure investments, I think, will play an important role in this, how we continue to move forward with them. And the same thing with retiring current health care. Some of the changes you made a few weeks ago will positively impact the budget circumstances. They were good moves for everyone. Continue to monitor active health care costs as well. So the guidance for the 2021 budget, this was what I gave department heads, two budgets to produce so we could begin our conversations internally. And this creates an interesting dynamic in that under normal circumstances, the legislature approves a target budget or a fiscal target, and that is the building block of which is usually the baseline. And anything above that baseline is then considered an over target request. It's a little harder in this situation because there hasn't been a fiscal target for good reason. Everything we just talked about for the past hour or so is good reason on why it's been difficult to give a fiscal target. What we'll probably do is start from the 12% reduction perspective in terms of that being the baseline, and anything above that will be coming in as an OTR. Some of it may be making whole in certain areas, and some of it may be one-time versus target. But that's probably going to be the baseline as we move forward. So the consistency in being able to look at everything from an apples-to-apples perspective. Budget reductions, again, given direction that they should look at personnel, as they look at personnel decisions to start with vacancies, forward turn in terms of investment with technology and also with what's critical to their mission in terms of programming. OTRs, again, my communication with staff as well as the agencies was is that it seems to be very clear, very justified, and I do not want just repurposed budget reduction. So I don't want them to, you know, skirt the process of saying, well, I'm just going to cut here just to repropose this. It needs to be substantive. It needs to be, you need to challenge the business as usual approach. We'll continue with the OTR tracking again, as well as RBA was going to be replacing the result. Based accountability was going to be replacing the impact assessments. That's been a little bit on the slow uptake only because of some of the layoffs and the staff that we've had, furloughs and some of the staff we've had been working on has been furloughed. But we'll continue as we put this budget together. One thing I have changed with this process is I've been available well before the budgets were submitted to the staff, as well as any agencies if they have questions, so we could have some preliminary discussions before they submit. And obviously we'll have in-depth discussions over the next month and a half, but we've had a lot of questions, a lot of follow-up. Want to make sure that it was an open discussion with everyone so that if they had any questions, we could answer them earlier in the processes so they can put together good budgets. I think that's just about the gist of it. You know, one thing I told them is some departments will be impacted differently. That's just how it's at the end of the day, you've got a department of 180 and you've got a department of one person. And it's not going to be, you know, they're not going to be flat across the board at the end of the day, in terms of impact every department. And some of it is going to be based on the circumstances. So just wanted them to be aware of that as we go into the budget process. But so far, all my conversations with department heads and agencies have been positive in terms of them thinking proactively how they want to approach this. We'll have, as we have in the past, we'll have good discussions in the next month and a half as we put the budget together. I think that is the last of the slides. I just continued this, kept this slide in there because it's not a marathon. It's not a sprint. It's not a marathon. It's a triathlon, really, to get through this over the course of the next few years. And there'll be new opportunities that will come out of the challenges that we face. So that's the end of the presentation. If you want to take the I can stop sharing, or if there's a specific slide folks want me to come back to, I can come back to it.
Well, I saw, thank you, Jason. I saw Annie's hand up, so I don't know if it's on a specific slide. Ann?
Yes, thank you, Martha. Jason, thank you for this presentation and all the work you're doing for this. I know this is hard things to look at, and we really do appreciate your knowledge and compassion when you're thinking about all these issues that affect the community and our staff So my one question on the slide that's up there, you mentioned under OTR request, the last one, do not just re-propose budget reductions. I didn't understand what you meant by that.
Basically, what I didn't want to happen is you know, they're all given a task of reducing their budgets by 12% of the local share, which generally, for most cases, are probably going to be position reductions, just to cut it and then just to re-propose it. I wanted them to, you know, there has to probably be some structural change to the budget and the way they provide services and challenge themselves and their staff as to how they're going to continue to do that. I didn't want them just to go through an exercise just to re-propose it.
Thank you.
All right. Other questions or comments for Jason before we... I'm sorry, who?
Deborah,
you're not using the blue hands.
No, I'm using the white hands.
Okay, because if I don't have you on your little picture on my screen, I don't see that. So.
Okay, I'll try to do better in the future.
Okay.
I'm a little confused, Jason. I know that there's just so much information in this, and like Annie, I appreciate the fact that you're trying to figure out a way to do this, hurting the fewest of our employees and fewest of our programs. But on your slide for the fund balance, I think it's slide 20 on the first, you're talking about using fund balance to get us through 2020. This slide isn't even getting us through 2021, is it?
Correct. It's a good point to bring up. So this is really saying year end 2020, this is what your fund balance could look like depending on these variables. So I'll pay your attention if you can see my cursor. You see this right here where it says one-time OTRs? This is generally, you know, within a 1.5 to $2.2 million range is what the legislature many times appropriates for one-time OTRs, which is essentially using fund balance to fund part of your budget, right? You know, this may, if you were to say, all right, out of all of these things here on this first block, Tioga Street purchase is a one-off. That won't happen again. The $2 million transfer, that won't happen again. Rollover, that will probably happen again, as well as rollover in the future year for 21 may happen again. So if you were to take, basically, if I take this mild scenario here, this $28.5 million, okay, and I were to subtract out, say, another $2.5 million, because let's say that's what you typically use for one-time OTRs and over, then that might be your fund balance going, you know, after your adopted budget for 2021, which would be another, you'd get $26 million, okay? That may be a way of projecting what you would have available to you for 2021. You know, obviously, the more fund balance you may use for one-time OTRs, this would bring this number lower. But that would give you an understanding of how that would move moving forward. Now, one thing I'll add is that there might be a reason. So when you talk about using fund balance in future years, one thing to think about is you definitely don't, I would not encourage you use it to support your general operations. But there are things like equipment purchases. There are certain things that you can pull out that are target now that you can maybe slowly grow back into using fund balance to ease that cushion. So I'll give you an example. I'm not saying this will happen, but I'm just going to give you an example. Every year we purchase a certain amount of vehicles in a specific department because they rotate through them every year, right?
Right.
We budget $200K a year on that. Well, maybe we pull some of that out and we say, all right, over the next, we take $1,000 out of it and we'll say the target's going to decrease by $100,000, but over the next 3 years, we'll use $100,000 this year. We'll use maybe $50,000 next year and $25,000 the year after, and every scale back into it so that you're then putting back into target over a period of time, assuming the economy will recover a little bit and your revenues will start to grow. I could see where we might use a little bit more one-time OTR, so to speak, or one-time, multi-year one-times to kind of ease, take some of the pressure off of the target and ease back into it over the next, say, 2 to 3 year period of time. That's how you could use fund balance in a positive way moving forward. Using the key to that is using less of it as you move forward in subsequent years.
Yeah, I'm just concerned because the big uncertainty, as far as I'm concerned, is how long this crisis is going to last. I just want to sit on as much fund balance as we can in case it lasts for a really long time.
Yeah. I mean, if you really think about things for a second, you'll get yourself into a bad place. But, you'll start saying, oh, my God, recovery will not happen very promptly. The state, cut us 30% aid, and it's just sales tax is going to be stagnant. You're going to sit there and you're going to go, oh, my God, if we have this severe scenario 2-3 years in a row, it's just going to be horrible. You can't. Obviously, you could really get into a bad place pretty quick by thinking that way. But that's why the ranges, I think, are important, the mild and severe. And that's why, we're talking about what we think is worst and the best case scenario in those situations. So you just have to, every month we're learning new information to try to hone those numbers a little bit better.
I think we have to plan from a bad place, though, unfortunately.
You have to plan from a bad place, but you also have to plan from a places you can be, right? I mean, you want to be conservative. You don't want to be overly conservative, just as you don't want to be, not conservative enough. I mean, I know that's a very difficult thing to say, but you have to be, you can't cut to the bone and everything, but just you have to balance it as reasonable as you can. That's kind of why I have them submit two ranges in the budgets in terms of the staff. Some will be cut a little bit more than others, depending on the programming, depending on the priorities, and so on and so forth. But it's a tough balance, and throw in the uncertainty, it makes it even tougher.
Let me, Mike Lane, I see your hand. Before to follow up on that, for example, that the one-time OTR is $2.1 million. That includes, Jason, if I'm right, things like, I don't know, did we put $180,000 to Upstate College Initiative as a one-time when we did three-year funding for the Child Development Council, things like right? Law work. Yes. So those are, and if we can take some time in a little bit to go through some, like those, the criteria, the one pager I sent out, sort of questions, how do we make these decisions? We can talk about that. Because basically I think every nickel we spend can surely be defended as providing value. I think that's pretty, maybe not every single nickel, but, we really do examine every expenditure, and I think there's a justification for all of it. But some of these things, we just may have to bite a bullet and say, those are really nice. We wish we could fund those, but maybe not for the next year or next 2 or 3 years. So that's the kind of line that $2.1 million represents. Is that true, Jason?
Yeah, I mean, that's you're right in terms of those things you identified. Those are part of that one-time OTR.
Okay. Mike Lane, then I see Anna again.
If you're still on the slides, I can wait, but I just wanted to know when we're going to get into general discussion.
Why don't you go ahead, Mike?
A couple of things. Been thinking about our 0.75% going to of the levy going into the capital fund, and maybe we're going to have to drop that back to the 0.5% we've had previously. I'm just throwing a few things out. I think we're going to have to think seriously about doing 2 or 3 dog and pony shows about the new budget. We haven't done those in a few years either, but I think with the changes, I think we ought to try to go out into the communities somewhere down in the city and perhaps one on each side of the lake. I've been kicking this around in my head, and maybe it's not possible, but I'd like to see us talk about a surcharge on our real property tax to let people know that it's temporary. Now, I realize we can say, well, we'll just raise it this year, and maybe we can reduce it again next year. Well, we know that won't get reduced the following year. If we could say it was a surcharge that we're putting on because of the COVID crisis for a year or two, for example, even if we have to frame it as one figure, on the actual tax bill, because New York State won't let us do that. I do think it might come across to the people who are paying the taxes as understandable. But nobody likes to have it just raised, their taxes raised in a crisis, and know they'll never go back down again. So I just wanted to throw that out as a thought.
Mike, before you go on,
I'm at that point.
What does that sort of mean? I'm not sure if there's...
Well, let's say we have our tax cap at whatever it is. But let's say we need another percent or 5% on the levy to raise our real property taxes. Then we say that we are going to have a surcharge for 1 year of 5% over and above what we've got to get to. And I understand the logistics of it might be a little more complicated, but it would give our taxpayers some kind of hope that it wouldn't last forever. That's all I'm trying to say.
I understand the idea. I was wondering if there's a legal mechanism to do that.
We can only do whatever the state law allows us to do. I'm sure probably Jay and Jason will tell us that, but we could still couch it in such a way that it sounds like we might be taking seriously our obligation to reduce it in the future. It's just a thought I wanted to throw out for people to think about.
Thank you, Anna.
Just I appreciate, Martha, what you were saying, that you created a list of questions to figure out how we evaluate and where cuts are made. I guess the only thing that I want to make sure, or I would like to see in that process of questioning, is from a racial justice lens, that there are not things that are cut that would promote the equity that we are fighting for. You know, I think, like you mentioned, College Upstate Initiative, and the research that they have shown from that and the impact or reduction in recidivism, for example, I think that the negative impact of cutting it would be greater than the cost of it, as far as our efforts with racial justice. So that's just the only thing I wanted to add, that I hope that is part of the evaluation of the programs that we have in all of our departments and agencies.
So that leads me into, at the end of our agenda is legislative priorities and criteria for decision-making and discussion. Let's go through any other questions on sort of the nuts and bolts and the numbers. And then I figured out how to share my screen. I feel so proud of myself. And so I want to try to put that list of questions up on. And we're not going to give Jason guidance as we usually do. We're not going to say your target is 3.2% levy or whatever. But I think a discussion here basically of our values and the different considerations we want to go through, the things that are important to us. And I'm not going to ask for any vote on particular values or particular directions, but I think if we can have a bit of an open-ended discussion, maybe that would be useful. I do have a couple of other nuts and bolts questions. Jason, you mentioned casino money, and I can't, where is that figured in?
Unallocated revenue.
What?
Unallocated revenue.
So you saw that as going down $1.5 million?
I'd have to look exactly what it was decreased. I know we have it decreasing this year for obvious reasons, and then I think we'll have it decreasing for next year as well. I'd have to look again to see specifically. There's a bunch of revenues in there, but yeah, we had it decreasing.
Okay. And has there been any kind of idea from the governor about whether the casinos are going to open, and if so, when? Is that like phase 5 or 6?
No phase. Is that beyond phase 4? It's just, they've got, I know, any industry, whether it's a gym or a mall or a casino, has been working to try to develop their reopening or reactivation plan, similar to higher ed. They've got a difficult, I mean, the governor's even acknowledged casinos got a real difficult lift. I mean, you're dealing with seats that are, a foot from each other, and you're all touching the same thing. So I have no idea how they're going to do that.
forgo the revenue and avoid the infections. So, and I just want to mention to folks that a number of years ago, and well, I cannot even remember, I don't know, it wasn't the Great Recession, it was earlier than that. We had a serious task force looking at whether we should try to impose a local income tax. A few of the veterans here will remember. And it was, I think Tim Joseph was chair at the time. It was something we looked at, you know, at in depth because we thought, well, if, you know, property tax is fairly, is quite regressive as a tax. You're, you know, you may have purchased your home when you were working and now you're retired. Many reasons why it's a difficult tax for folks. You can't, you don't want to lose your home because you can't pay that tax. Whereas income tax is progressive. If you have a better year, pay more. If you have a worse year, you're paying less. We, after a great deal of study by a really a top-notch community group, they really identified this. If any part of our tax income switched over to income tax, it actually would have a bizarre sort of counterintuitive effect by it would mean the business sector and the non and the large property taxpayers would actually be relieved of some of their tax burden if you put it onto income tax for individuals. So it was something we studied for a long time and really decided that it would have sort of the opposite effect we were looking for. So that's I just want to mention that as another one of the big picture thoughts that we looked at and probably would go back to. So Mike or Leslin might remember more about it if they want to add something in on that.
I can just add that the surrounding counties were in shock that we even were talking about it. Worried about their our commuters from those counties coming in here and possibly being taxed. Seneca County, for one, passed a resolution, and we hadn't even proposed anything. We hadn't even talked about it on the floor. So it was it sent out shockwaves.
I see in the chat, Annie asked if that report exists. Kathy Covert, you might be able to find that somewhere.
I can check our records and see what we have on file.
Okay, great. Somebody needs more stuff to read. Anything else on the nuts and bolts, the numbers, and what Jason has proposed and, you know, is presenting here?
Yes, I have a question. Dan.
Dan, go ahead.
I don't know if this is the right moment to ask it or if there's anything to be said, but I'm wondering about how we're going to think about or how we are thinking about potential employee layoffs this year or furlough through the end of, you know, through the end of the month, and then what?
Yes. So one of the discussions I'm having with department heads next week are those are just that, you know, what positions, some positions may be proposed to being eliminated in the budget. Some positions are slotted to come back to do some work. So the question is, you know, do we continue the furlough through the end of the year, continuing with our health insurance before, you know, once the budget's adopted, if those positions are eliminated, then finally, separate from service. That would probably be the preferable route. But right now it's probably 20 or so positions that fall in that category. So it's a conversation I'm going to start to have with department heads when I get back, next week.
So kind of handled on a department-by-department basis, looking at individual positions. And
right. I mean, some of it will be offset by if there are expected retirements that are going to happen within that time frame. And, you know, positions can be, you know, folks can be shifted into those roles or, you know, just not, you know, there might be opportunity for them to shift into different roles. So it's not a static conversation. It's fluid depending on different decisions that are made.
And even the furlough calculations that we made could, as we're hearing that the feds very likely might not continue that $600 addition on unemployment insurance. So wouldn't that change the calculation, Jason, for some of our employees who right now being hurt by this?
It would. The challenge with this whole process, which is kind of backwards, is that furloughs were made based on, you know, a lot of the furloughs were made based on you know, partly on this enhanced benefit, not based on generally how you would make furloughs or layoff decisions, be based on need, or based on you know, an area where you needed to reduce. So it's kind of created a misconception, I think, an expectation when you start talking about furlough and laying off employees and positions. So it creates this expectation that, well, when that enhanced benefit is over, then everybody can come back. Well, the truth is you still have a severe financial problem after, you know, come August 1st. It's still a challenge to balance. And some of these positions may be proposed as being eliminated in the future budget. So it's created a situation that is definitely nothing we've ever dealt with before. The circumstance we were able to reduce expenses for a short period of time and not impacting employees at the time negatively because of this enhanced benefit. It also has created a little bit of an unreal circumstance and you know, how furloughs and layoffs are really dealt with. The other thing to consider also is that there were, you know, a decent amount of folks that volunteered to furlough because they forfeited their civil service rights for that period of time, which means if these positions were to be, you know, furloughed for an extended period of time, they would have the ability to, you know, basically change that waiving of their civil, of their seniority rights. So it may impact the different employees separately. So.
And I thought I saw Deborah's hand. I thought I saw a little blue hand.
No, Jason actually anticipated my question and answered it.
Okay. All right. Thanks. Annie?
Thank you, Martha. I was just wondering, Jason, how many people are furloughed right now? You don't, if you know off the top of your head, part-time and full-time?
It's about 75 right now that are furloughed. About the 98 or so, 75 are furloughed right now.
Okay. And as another thing, as I thought you said at a meeting or somebody said that at the end of July, maybe the last week in July, that the federal incentive might stop versus going through the whole of July. Is that correct?
Yeah, so something, you know, there's when this started, July 31st was the last date that this benefit could be received. And it looks like there's been a mid-course correction in the way the state has and the way the federal legislation has been interpreted in that it's no longer July 31st. In New York State, it's July 26th. So this was not anything we anticipated or anybody anticipated. In fact, the Department of Labor's website changed when this interpretation came out last week. So this is a mid-course correction, and basically our approach is that if folks are going to be recalled back in service, they'll be recalled effective July 26th. If they weren't going to be recalled, they won't be. And, you know, we'll just bump up that date a week. It's a little concerning, but, you know, this is, you know, it happened mid last week, you know, without much forewarning and, frankly, without much advance notice from the state. They didn't really tell anybody about this. You know, we got wind of it, dug into it a little bit, and then we're able to, you know, and the language still is vague in terms of interpretation of federal law and how it's being interpreted. But that seems to be what the state has changed with their website. So it's not a July 31st date. It's a July 26th date.
Okay. I'm totally shocked that New York State would change their mind abruptly about something without giving us advance warning. So another thing I'm wondering if this is in your wheelhouse as a consideration that some people might be furloughed for a couple of more months or you mentioned through the end of the year possibly. Are you looking at different scenarios with that?
Yes. That's all part of the conversation I'm going to have next week with everybody and try to understand. Either way, I would continue the furlough with, you know, continuing health insurance through however long they're furloughed. And if it does result in an elimination of the position, this we want to talk about is if there are any impacted employees or there are opportunities to apply for any other vacant positions that come up. Obviously, they're entitled to certain civil right privileges in terms of to the titles if they're furloughed. or laid off. So positions are abolished under civil service rules. Certain positions are allowed, you know, they'll be recalled first on the civil service list rather than anybody else. So we have to kind of sift through a lot of that to understand it. But, yes, you could be talking about extended months or until the end of the year.
Well, last just comment I want to say, I'm glad that we're looking at trying to keep health insurance as long as we can for people. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I think it's a reasonable thing to do under the circumstances. I know a lot of people aren't, but if we can, we should, and we'll try to continue that if we have to keep people out.
Jason, if I can understand, when you looked at which individuals to furlough, you kind of had a picture of looking at people where their income level was such that with the $600 plus up, they would either do as well or even better under a furlough. If that $600 goes away, does the calculation change as to who even you should consider for furlough? In other words, if it's just who's, you know, I don't want to say more defensible, but does it change the calculation of who you would furlough?
It doesn't change it, only because I go back to my original statement, is that when you're talking about furloughing and laying off positions, you generally don't take into consideration what we took into consideration, which is, you know, the gross, you know, what can be benefited from the unemployment benefit in that sense. I mean, it's just so usually not part of the conversation. Now you're at a point in the conversation of a variety of factors of potentially restructuring departments, proposing eliminations of positions. You still have financial challenges, which is usually the primary reason you're talking about laying off or furloughing employees. So while that was a benefit at the time because we could consider it, it's not really part of the calculation, unfortunately, which is where I think, you know, the value of continuing, you know, generally also speaking, you know, most employers don't continue health insurance for a period of time beyond furlough or layoff, you know, and I still think that's a fair reason to do for even if it's for a 6-month period of time.
Shauna?
Hi, I just wanted to ask, as far as communication with staff, is there an employee town hall that's scheduled? Because I think it would be really nice just to give people the heads up sooner than later. I'm sure there are probably a few employees tuning into this evening's meeting, but, you know, just because I think the last time they had correspondence, it was saying, you know, essentially you're furloughed, you know, hopefully, you know, more than likely, hopefully, I don't know what the wording was used, but we'll see you back in the workforce as of, you know, August. And I think if we could kind of give people the heads up sooner than later, that would be really helpful for many people.
So we have been having staff town halls every Friday. Questions come up, everyone, and I've said the same thing. Everyone is, you know, come the first, second week in July, we hope to make those decisions. Everyone has known that, you know, this could extend beyond that end of July date, and we've reinforced that. So I think the message we're talking about now is the same message that's been out there. We will continue to, as we have, trying to keep it as open and communicative as folks as we can as possible, letting them know as early as possible when we can. Absolutely. We'll continue to do that.
Jason, if we're all, you know, we and Governor Cuomo and everybody else waiting to find out about federal aid, how much can you, let's pretend we get a promise, you know, that they vote something and Amanda Spellacy tells us we're going to get X amount of money. How much can you, like the EFMAP money, can you basically count as if we have it, even though the cash flow will be longer delayed? I mean, can you then calculate based, assuming that that money will show up?
So some of it depends on how the aid can be claimed. If it's based on expenses, you know, certain expenses qualify for it, then it could be an accounts receivable. In that sense, and that would count, you know, meaning we would all talk about, you know, it all depend on when we would apply for a resubmission or reimbursement of it, you know, on an ongoing basis. So some discussion we would have, you know, Rick and I would have about, you know, the law written and how is it qualified? Is it, you know, is it for lost revenue or is it for qualified expenses? Generally, it's the latter. And if that's the case, then it would depend on how we file for that reimbursement, and you know what you'd be eligible for. So, you know, it spans quite a bit. Generally, it's generally just not a check. Even with TCAT and the airport, it's against qualified expenses, right? So that's probably where we would look at it. It would be an accounts receivable of some sort that we would have, that Rick would work his accounting magic with to ensure that accounts for in the year. So I think that's probably how it would work. I'll just caution this about federal aid and a stimulus. A stimulus package, you know, a fourth stimulus package that provides a level of aid addresses one thing and one thing only, and that's now. It does not address the longer-term impact of recovery in future revenues per se, unless it's continued aid in perpetuity or over a certain series of years. So while we may be able to minimize the operating deficit this year with an aid package of, say, $7 million, it does not address next year's shortcomings, which will most likely continue in terms of a slowing economy, right? So we have to keep in mind that a federal aid package is good for the probably primarily for the fund balance discussion. It does not necessarily address longer-term issues with the budget in terms of it doesn't necessarily address what could happen with the tax rate next year. Because if you don't have a constant revenue source that's going to equal where we are now, and without corresponding decreases in expenses, you're still going to be in a difficult budget position next year. So I want to make sure that we don't bank too much on a federal aid package. While critically important, and again, would not pass up if it was offered to us, it will help our financial position longer term, sure, with not, tapping fund balance. Nonetheless, it will not avoid that 10% tax increase discussion for next year. One could argue that an infusion in a fourth stimulus package into government and keeping governments, running as full force as possible will help the economy recover quicker, but that's an academic exercise, I think, more than an immediate one. So I just want to make sure that everyone understands that's important. Fourth stimulus is important, but it's not going to solve your budget problem in 21, 22.
Thanks. Anna.
You may have partly answered my question. I was, and maybe this is the academic part of juggling, where you get the short term and you can use, because we have the two. We have the fund balance, but we also have the capital. Where we shift our expenses and capital, whether we postpone or we use the federal for capital and save our fund balance so that next year, if we also have a need for the fund balance, then we've preserved it. Is that what you meant by the juggling?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, so capital, capital plan is antiquated the day it's adopted, right? I mean, all of a sudden changes, twists and turns happen with projects. Some get pushed back, some come in under budget, some come in over budget. So when we go through this process, we recalibrate it, we look at new ones, we look at old ones, and then timing issue of, well, when do we think this one's going to start, and when do we think that one's going to start, and how sure are we on our engineering estimates? And some of the larger ones are, less sure than the smaller ones. So it's a timing issue. It's the likelihood that this project will start in 2023 versus 2025. And then, the money, as you look at annual costs, meaning how much you're going to be putting out related to capital costs, that's when you're going to start to look at that annual contribution.
Well, and we also don't know yet if some of the money, if we do get funding, will all the funding be unallocated, unrestricted? Some of it may be restricted. We don't know any of that yet. We have gotten no indication, right?
Right. It's all true. It's all true. I mean, yes, answer your question. So, I mean, it's a balancing act of resources and priorities and, timing.
All right. Thank you, Jason, and thanks to Kevin and all the other staff who worked on this really tough problem, this multifaceted, multi-layer problem, and we appreciate that. There are a lot of moving pieces here, and it's a unique year. Certainly, we are faced with some things we've never had to face before. So, sure. We really appreciate the work that's gone into this. I hope the rest of your week off is going to actually be a week off, part of a week off. But so, thank you all, and once again to Greg Potter and Lauren Cottrell, who are sitting through this as our IT support team. It really appreciate that that they've been with us on that and with us from the beginning of this to make it possible for us to meet this way. It's been great. I'm going to go ahead and see if I can share this screen that I put together and see if we can stimulate. Can folks see that? See that screen there with the how do we make hard choices in a difficult budget year?
Can you enlarge it, Martha? I can't. It's too small.
Okay.
Just on the bottom right where it has it as 100%, the bar from 0 to 100% on the bottom right.
Okay.
Of your screen, if you move that far.
Come on, girl. There we go. Okay. You do have this in your inbox. I see what I'm doing. Hold on. And you know, I did email it today, but I wanted to have it all in front of us. All right. Come on. Let's go. Let's see. All right. So I really, you know, these are the kinds of questions that this is sort of the soft part of budget making is how do you, you know, how do you weigh one terrific thing against something else, and how do we end up with something that matches what as a community we think we is going to represent what our sorry about this. What our constituents really value and what we feel has worked well for us in the past, and how do we make these kinds of choices? So how do we allocate resources to the programs and services that provide the greatest value to our residents? What considerations are important to you? I think we're also – we're certainly aware of the constraints we have, and I – you know, I agree with Mike Lane's idea of taking this to the public. And frankly, because of Zoom, we don't even have to have it on one side of the lake or another. We, anybody can come to, everybody's as geographically, you know, able to join in a public meeting if, wherever it's held, when, you know, if we do this by public, by Zoom again. So, we could solicit public comment sort of directly that way. But we know among the things that are sometimes hard to explain to the public are the things that we actually have to do, you know, the mandates where we have no discretion. We just get a bill for Medicaid, for example. We have mandated responsibilities, services we have to provide, but we may have flexibility in how we do them. We have to have a probation department. How many probation officers do we have is kind of is up to us. We have to run a jail. Exactly how do we do that is somewhat under our discretion. Then we have this sort of strings attached bucket of programs, things where our funding is tied to some but to other partners. We, you know, TCAT is an obvious example, TC3, obvious example. Some other subtleties, for example, as Mike Lane has correctly pointed out many times, if we cut funding to the library and to TC3, those are examples of programs where if we don't maintain our funding at least the same amount as the previous year, we can lose state aid. So there are things like that where there are nuances to our decision making where we might want to save money in one of those areas, but the risk is of losing other funding that we don't want to let go. So those are some of our kind of constraints. So that gets to the opportunities or, you know, where we have discretionary services, the things that are entirely our choice or, as I said, with under the mandated responsibilities where we have some flexibility in how we provide those services. And then to end up with, you know, what are our values? What programs or services or personnel would we like just really scrap and make sure we protect that program just, you know, because that's something that we really want to make sure Tompkins County does, and continues to do. So, with that, I really am interested in kind of just letting people talk through this. I see, I think I've got Amanda's hand already, but I want to, you know, I just want to open this up. As I said, we're not giving Jason direction on a target, but maybe we can give direction in terms of some qualitative analysis of what we think is important this year. Amanda.
Thank you. Well, that was going to kind of be my question. Like, what is Jason looking for tonight? What, like, I mean, there's a lot of us, and we probably all have very different priorities. So I'm just a little bit unclear on, I mean, we can have a conversation, but what are you looking for, Jason, if anything? If you're there still.
I mean, I don't know if you can give me any direction right now, to be honest with you, unless you, I mean, generally the direction comes in terms of a target, fiscal target, and that's usually how we build the budget around. I don't know that you can give that advice or that direction right now unless you feel comfortable adopting a fiscal target. Outside of that, I think the budget discussion and debate is where you're going to have to determine, you know, as you do every year, what's important and what you want to fund and what you don't want to fund. You know, it's a difficult conversation right now only because of so many uncertainties. I don't know that I have a great answer for you, to be honest with you, Amanda. I'm not trying to be coy or anything. I'm just I don't know if there's any direction you can give me.
Okay. Yep. Thanks.
Yeah, to be clear, Jason didn't ask me to put this on the agenda. I just thought it was worth taking some time if we could, you know, talk to each other, talk to the staff, and see where it goes. I see Shauna's hand.
Thank you. With us seeing a downward spiral of our economy and more people out of work, you know, it's unfortunate because I think what we will see is the need for more social services and the need for more organizations that provide services to people that are homeless, that are struggling with rent, that are food insecure. And so I would, you know, I know, you know, right now this might even, you know, be a debate amongst all of us, but I would be very apprehensive to cut funding for those, because I think this is where our community is going to need our help, and at least keeping the funding and even perhaps, you know, talk about increasing it at some point.
Thanks, Sean. I'm going to go to Rich next, and then Anna.
Thank you.
Martha, can I get in the queue, please, Dan?
Yeah, you bet.
Thank you.
Thanks, Martha. This is a general conversation. Obviously, we can't be too specific, but the thing that I keep coming back to that I worry about is that we've been, frankly, a national leader on our jail population, on our criminal justice system, our alternatives to incarceration. And we have done just outstanding things. And right now, you know, you look at how the weight of the problems we're facing fall. They fall on the most marginalized populations. And these are the people that are most likely to get involved with our criminal justice system. And this is where my worry is. I agree with what Shauna said. I'm thinking we want to perhaps try to think about how do we front load so that we get people jobs if we can, so that we're not relying on them getting social services. We're helping them before they get there. I think we are in an emergency that the federal protection money is hiding, that August is going to potentially be just awful. And we need to be thinking, how do we do job opportunities as fast as we can? One thing I'm encouraged by, and we're seeing it at the IDA, is that developers aren't slowing down, that large building projects are continuing to go forward. This is really good news if they actually get built. I've been driving around looking at some of the projects. You know, Herald Square was dead for quite a while. They're working on that one again. Library Place, I'm really curious what's happening there. But construction jobs are good immediate employment, and they generate all sorts of spin-off work in the community. I've also been talking to Diane Cohen at Finger Lakes Reuse and trying to figure out, is there a way to really bump up what they're doing, particularly because everybody's been at home cleaning their garages and attics and basements. And seriously, Finger Lakes Reuse has been doing almost its typical revenue on an appointment basis. They can't, you know, accept donations on the just walk in the door right now. But she's anticipating a tsunami. And that means if it can be managed, there's some potential real jobs there. So that's what I've been thinking about and worrying about.
Okay, great. Thank you. Anna, Dan, and I see, I'm actually not able to see all the participants. Did I miss anybody who else has their hand up? Okay, Anna, then Dan.
Yeah, I second Shauna and Rich's comments. Those were some that I was thinking as well, and so I just want to say I absolutely agree with those comments. That specifically we should prioritize those aspects of our budget that will increase the rate to which the most vulnerable populations are able to recover. And when you talk about the 12%, you know, creating that baseline of 12%, I'm assuming that's an average and that the priorities may mean that some departments don't experience a full 12%, others may experience more. So that was my one question for you, Jason. Are you looking at that 12% flat across the board as a starting point, or are you adjusting it based off of that it is an average and you're looking at some, like I think about workforce development specifically and, you know, helping people retrain, get back into jobs, helping the creation of jobs seems like a very important part of our economic recovery, for example. And I certainly wouldn't want to reduce the rate at which that happens. For example, that's just one.
Yes.
So that was a question.
Yeah, no, I think so. Everyone is. Deborah has a question too.
Okay.
Everyone is. Every department is completing the same two budgets, but they know it's a starting point of discussion. And I've been very clear that there are some departments that will have greater challenges than others when we come when what's recommended to the legislature. It's just that's going to be the case. You know, I would also offer that. There may be some departments that are going to be creating new positions while others may be eliminating them or even laying off employees. So it's not always going to be an apples for apples comparison by department, which is, you know, we're going to do the best we can to minimize that, but that could be a reality.
Well, and that's also the case with agencies because, like Rich mentioned, some of our ATIs are implemented. Like when we have programs like the community outreach worker, I would not want to see that program reduced because that the need for that is probably going to increase. So, you know, some of those considerations I think are really important. And then the other thing, Rich, that you brought up, and I'm glad you brought up the IDA. I know that the IDA is looking into a policy for inclusion of affordable housing. And for years we've been looking, or you've been looking at, as the chair of the IDA, I mentioned, there are other members, but looking at a local labor policy. So it seems that those are two avenues right now that could be particularly helpful for this economic recovery. But it's a tricky balancing act, so.
Thanks, Anna. I'm going to Dan and then Deborah. Let me mention also the wrinkle that, Jason, I think you said 12% local share is the, you know, departments are supposed to come back with 12% local share. So, for example, in DSS, where many employees are, say, 50% reimbursed or 30%, public health is 30% or whatever, you're to get a 12% overall 12% cut is going to actually be harder to do in those departments. Is that right?
Yeah, it's definitely a difficult not everyone's on the same playing field, so to speak, because of that. You know, so for example, a perfect example is there were a few positions that we are filling with DSS, you know, like four or five positions, and the net impact to us is, you know, 30, 40 grand, you know, for four or five positions. So it's just, that's just the nature of the conversation. It creates a very different conversation with different departments based on those circumstances.
Okay, thanks. Dan?
Thank you. I want to bring up a topic that I'm probably going to stumble through a little bit, but I think I have a question at the end of it. Even the question's a little hard to frame. So it's defund the police. It's something that we're hearing a lot, and I believe we're going to have to respond to that. And as I look around at preliminary, at what some municipalities are doing as a preliminary response to that, there's a wide range of responses already. And as I understand it, you know, what most people mean when they say defund the police is to decrease law enforcement budget and take some of that money and put it in more social services, for lack of a better term. My question is, how are we going to respond to that request / demand? Our budget is a response, but can we respond, will we be able to respond with more of a narrative? And will that be something that the legislature can generate that narrative? Or is it going to be the budget itself that's going to be the narrative? Or, and this is what I don't want to have happen, are we going to have 14 different narratives about how the county is responding to that? So that was my best attempt to put that out, what I was trying to say.
It's pretty good. I like that.
Thank you.
Jason, do you want to answer? I don't know if Rich, you want to answer that.
I was just going to say that we should have a response. It's incredibly complicated because, one, you know, decide what you want and then make your budget. You don't decide on your budget and then try to figure out, okay, we defund the police, what does it mean? But as a slogan, it kind of makes sense. It's expressing the urgency. To give one example of how complicated this is, I've also heard and read quite a bit about de-escalation and how important it is that police officers should have de-escalation training. And it is important, but frankly, if you send police officers in with the goal of de-escalating, it takes a lot longer. And if you're saying we're going to have fewer police officers and they're going to do de-escalation, you're going to have a much harder time running a police force. You know, you won't be able to respond to all the calls necessarily. That's the kind of decision that we're going to need to face. None of this is easy. I think we need to have the conversation. We need to try to get there, but man, is it hard. But Dan, I agree with you entirely that if we can, as a body, reach some consensus about what direction we want to go, we'd be far better off than having 14 fragmented responses. And the one other thing I'd mention is we're doing some really good things. Say the Mobile Crisis Intervention Unit is doing a lot of the things, you know, that people are calling for, and they don't even know we're doing them. So we should be promoting that. Just a refresher, that's when a police officer can call these mental health professionals and basically hand off somebody who's having a mental health crisis instead of treating it like a criminal justice, you know, criminal problem. I'll stop talking.
And there may be ways to... for the dispatch center to, there may be training for dispatch workers to be able to triage differently depending upon the information that comes in. There may be things that we can do with the same personnel. I see Deborah is next.
Yeah, I hadn't really meant to comment on the defund the police thing, but my understanding of defunding the police means that you put more money into social services and supportive services so that there are fewer things that police are actually called upon to do, things that are otherwise inappropriate to their law enforcement function. But that does tie into what I wanted to say, which is that clearly this crisis has exacerbated and exposed all the weak points in our society, the inequities and the impact of every little thing that happens on the least capable people to deal with it, economically or otherwise. I've been hearing about our housing problems, our social services problems, our law enforcement problems since before I got on the legislature, and I'm not trying to understate the importance of those issues, but while we've been focusing on all of those, and while we're focusing on them in a laser-like manner right now, which I guess is understandable, we're kind of ignoring the overhanging big crisis that's been coming at us for years that we haven't really addressed, which is climate. So my ask, I guess, is that as we figure out how we're going to get back to normal, how we're going to support workforce development, how we're going to support the local economy, we think of ways to do that that are climate smart, energy smart, that create a normal that's not so fossil fuel dependent, that create jobs that are green energy jobs, that enable people to have, new careers and new paths that help us transition away from fossil fuels.
So kind of build back better.
Okay. Yes, ma'am.
I see Mike Lane, Ann Corman, Amanda. Mike Lane?
We need to be very careful about our agencies in this crisis. They are often on shoestring budgets, and their people are not overpaid. So we need to focus on protecting them as much as we can. Not that they can't share the pain also, but we have to keep in mind how much it hurts them more, possibly, than some of the others. I wondered about our contacts with our unions. Are they being asked to do anything? I know TC3 has been working with its unions out there, and they've been getting some success with the help from the unions. I just hope that our employees don't think it's business as usual because they've got a contract and that they ought to be immune from helping in this crisis. I've always been a person that wanted to maintain services. I've never been very pleased when we've had to cut something. Because the services we provide usually have been vetted extremely. You can go back to things like the mental health department. You can go back to solid waste, for example. All of those things were brought forward. Our health department is another one. Brought forward and became a solid part of our budget because they have a real need there. I still think about the only program that I ever voted to cut that I can think about was the CHA, and I still feel guilty about that. CHAs were the home nursing program sponsored by the county health department, and so many people called and said, "Please don't stop my nurses." please keep this. But all across the state, the CHAZs were being a lot of licenses were being sold, and then when there wasn't any money for that, they were just being eliminated. So think about, if you're talking about eliminating a program, how many people it will hurt, because it didn't come just on a whim. It came because it was important. Thanks.
Thanks, Mike. And Amanda, then Mike Sigler, and then I'll jump in. Annie?
Thanks, Martha. I just wanted to say a couple of things, two main things. The first thing is people are talking about the issue about defund the police, and there are people out there who have been saying for a long time and are saying now to defund the police entirely. So I just wanted to be clear about that, that there are some people that are actually saying that. There are then, and to get rid of incarceration. So some people are meaning other things like what people have already said, but I just wanted to clear that up, that people are saying that. The other thing that I wanted to say is regarding priorities, you know, and so we're each going to have different opinions. There is no, in kind of a way, there is no should, because we're kind of looking, we could be looking at this, at least from my opinion, we could look at how to reinvent government. What are our priorities? You know, listen to our citizens is huge in a way that we maybe haven't before, or more enhanced listening, because they need to be included. They are demanding to be included. And I know I said should, but I think we should listen to them. I mean, we work for them. So the other point I wanted to make was, to me, as Deborah said, the overarching issue for me is the planet is in crisis. And that's, to me, that's overarching, even though the other things that are going on now are huge. We have a huge economic crisis. We have a public health crisis. We have huge human rights issues. But if we don't look at them all together, as people have said, then, you know, if we make one less than the other, whether it's people that could be homeless at some point, whether it's people that are going to interact in our health system or our public safety or our employees, local businesses, if we don't try and figure out how to look at that all together, our agencies that we deal with and support. So I don't have one quick answer, but I think we need to each keep thinking about what are our priorities. I guess last I would just say that I want to be careful as we're listening to each other, you know, that we also really listen to each other. And I am been researching and will be bringing something forth to push for a local labor policy for the IDA. Thank you.
Thank you, Annie. Amanda's next.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks, Anne. I liked everything that you said. I just wanted to throw out there that a priority for me is that we do our very best to not lay people off from our organization. I think that there aren't going to be a lot of jobs, and not everyone is going to be able to get a construction job or, you know, an electrician job or whatever. Like, those jobs may exist, but I'm certainly not qualified to do one, and most of you aren't either. So I think that, you know, people are talking about jobs. I would like to see us keep as many people as we possibly can employed. Thanks.
Thanks, Amanda. Mike Sigler.
Hi, I really wasn't going to say too much, but just a couple of things. So listening to this whole discussion, I liked that Jason was going into fund balance and how we could mitigate some of the damage. To be honest, I mean, I wouldn't have been as comfortable digging as deep into fund balance, and now I'm at the point where I'm really comfortable digging into the fund balance. I mean, more so than maybe. I'm hoping that other people in the legislature are going to become comfortable with the idea that you may spend a quarter. I don't know if you're open to that, but over the next 2 years, I could see us spending down $10 million. I don't know if that's something that people have to come to terms with, and I understand, you know, listen, that may affect our credit rating. Hopefully it won't. I mean, that's something that Jason and Kevin and Rick are going to, I'm sure, tell us. They've already kind of alluded to it in other meetings I've had, but something that definitely I would imagine. We always say, oh, we're doing this so that in case of a rainy day, and I'm thinking, yeah, that's now. That's today. So the other thing I wanted to say, to defund the police, I wanted to say to all you folks, you have a lot to be proud of. I got interviewed by the paper, and it was like a half-hour interview. She used like two lines out of the whole thing. I was like, all right. But that whole interview, she's talking, and like, I'm like, listen, all the eight things that the mayor says he wants done, thanks to the current sheriff we have, and frankly, the sheriff we had before, we're there. We've done all those eight things. We're actually moving on to the next things. I feel like the legislature should take a lot of pride in the vote we did of what $1.3 million with the alternatives to incarceration that have lowered the jail population. So when people ask me about it, I go, listen, we've done a lot of the things you already asked for. We're actually to the next step. What do you think should happen next? Because we're on board with this. We're moving forward with it. And I think that's something that the county really should be proud of. And as for the whole defund, we're not going to need police. I don't know. I would answer that person like that's simply not going to happen. To act as if there's no people that we need to arrest in the county. We're simply you need a police force. And frankly, if you go down to a level, you may as well not have a police force. There's going to be a break point whereas you can't service the public. Right now, what do you have? 3 to 4 patrols on at night. You're pretty much there. I don't know how much lower you could go than that, frankly, and still have an effective sheriff's department. It would be like having a fire, you know, department, and you've got the guy driving the truck, but that's it, right? Okay, we need a man or woman on the hose, too. So I kind of feel that way about – and I don't feel that way just about the sheriff's department. You know, I look at mental health, too, and I look at the caseloads over at DSS. There's really – if you're dealing with 40 cases in DSS, yeah, there's really probably not too much further down the line you can go with that. So that's why I started off with the idea of, you know, if this really, I'm hoping this is just a rainy day and not a rainy, you know, month when it comes to this kind of spending. But that's it. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Mike. And before I add a few comments of my own, I just want to say I'm going to kind of also ask each of the folks who hasn't spoken yet and sort of ask you to really weigh in. And so nobody's going to be held later to what they've said tonight, but I think it's really a good time for us to try to reflect on what matters to us. So I'm going to just say I'm a little scared. I just feel like I want to agree with just about everything Mike Sigler said. So, scares me a little, but if this isn't a rainy day, I don't know what is. So I agree about the fund balance. I agree that we have a lot to be proud of in our criminal justice system, as Rich also said. One point, there have been some stories about a program in, I think it started in Eugene, Oregon, or maybe Portland. It's called CAHOOTS. I can't remember what the acronym stands for. It sounds a lot like LEAD. So I hope we really do dig into the ideas that are out there and see what might be possible to diversify the response to, you know, somebody calls 911, there's something happens. It's not automatically a road patrol deputy that responds. Let's figure out what, you know, what other choices we might be able to develop. On workforce training, I just want to say on a personal level, we're trying to get our house painted this summer, and everybody's too busy and nobody has enough workers to help. So I think there are a lot of, there really are some options if people, there's opportunity out there if we can find the right matches to get people into particular jobs. You're right, Amanda, not everybody's going to be an electrician, but I think there's opportunity in this community. And also, I wonder if I would like to diversify our thinking about the revenue side. We all can celebrate and thank the Legacy Foundation and Purity Ice Cream for supporting Alex Haley Poole. What other kinds of proposals can we make to our local funders or even national funders? We have a number of times gone to the Park Foundation with some big ideas, and they've worked with us and been able to bring funding in. So I hope we can put our creativity to work and try to think about ways we can, especially as we maybe try to do something, some things that are new and perhaps experimental, and see if there's outside money we can bring in. So those are some of the things I've been thinking of, and just wanted to toss those out there. We haven't heard from a few folks. Dave McKenna, do you have anything you wanted to throw out here?
Nothing to add. I totally agree with what Mike Sickler said, though, and I think going forward, defunding the police is just not something we need to do. It's going to create more problems than it's going to solve. So anyway, that's my two cents.
All right. Thank you very much. Glenn, I see you turned your video on.
I did, Martha. How are you?
Hi, how are you?
Well, I'm really concerned about this year's budget. In fact, it scares the heck out of me. I agree with Mike Ziegler. We can't make a decision on the police department or sheriff's department until we have the input of the sheriff. And I do believe he's farther advanced than any police departments I've heard of. But I really think we should look at budget totally and find out what part of the budget serves the county as a whole, not just small parts of it, but as a whole. And work with throughout that. So it's going to be an interesting season.
Do you mean the kind of departments that sort of build, support our, the rest of the departments, you know, ITS, that sort of thing? Is that what you mean?
Yes.
Okay. Thanks, Glenn. Leslin, hi, how are you? Leslin, I see your hand up.
I'm fine.
Hi.
So it's nice listening to everyone's opinions and priorities. It's, you know, I just wanted to sit back and hear a lot of what people are talking about. I'm going to start just a little bit with police. And we have an order from the governor, an executive order, to reimagine, reform, reinvent policing, which once we get through doing some of that work, which would involve community from the ground up, will present what our message is about policing. I would hate for us to say something in response now that doesn't go along with what comes out of these conversations we will have. And every municipality has to do that. Last week, Jason took the lead in, was it last week? I think so. Took the lead in pulling together a meeting with just about every municipality, policing agency represented, and the heads of the municipalities for us to talk through what are, how do we want to go about doing this? Is there something we can do collectively, you know, understanding that there are nuances that apply in various places. Across the board, the one thing that was for sure that everybody could agree on is that we didn't want to put a plan out for response. What we want to do is have the community, the folks who are talking about defunding and the folks who are talking about abolishing and getting rid of, involved in this conversation in reimagining policing and what that would look like. We're very sure of that. I don't think anybody on that call had any interest at all in getting rid of police. And Annie is right. There are a number of people in our community who feel that way and others who don't. So we'll continue that conversation, take the orders that came our way and work on that. We're working on it at the city level as we speak as well. The thing that just in listening to everyone is the word of the day, unprecedented times. We've gone through some hard times before. This is different. And so for me, there are no sacred cows. So I begin to get a little nervous when I hear very specific either departments or agencies being named, as opposed to us looking globally at what are our priorities. And I'm hoping that's where we will really go. If we put people in jobs, we have to create jobs. To put people in jobs, our economy will bounce back. People make money so they can be spending again. For me, that's how I look at priorities, as opposed to I have to preserve, you know, GIAC, or I have to preserve, you know, A, B, C, or D. Mike Lane started out way earlier talking about taking this dog and pony show on the road, which we did when we had one of the roughest budget years and got a lot of community input. And I think we can do that again. I agree with Mike on that, to get people's, you know, feedback on what are their priorities, so that we can, you know, put something out that's really good. I don't want to go on and on, but I particularly wanted to share around. We all got to be a little open-minded. There really are no sacred cows. I hate cutting certain things, but I'm willing to budge if it means that it'll help us float this boat for a little longer, however we do that. Martha, the last thing you said about looking at revenues, I think one of the things I'd ask of Jason is, are there places where we can increase fees that would make a difference? I don't know what all our fees are within the county. Something that would make a difference rather than property taxes. People respond a little better to fees than they do to increase taxes on your property sometimes. To sort of look at things like that, areas like that. I want to, our nonprofit organizations or agencies, so many of us rely heavily on foundations and community donations and that sort of stuff, that I would love for government to stay out of that. Especially at a time like now, because that's the one place that most of our nonprofit agencies can look to get some good support, the Park Foundation, the Community Foundation, all of those places. So I'd want us to think about that, and maybe help them to go there rather than us. Those are my thoughts.
All right. Thanks very much, Liz. And just one thing on the law enforcement issues. Then I see Henry, and I'm going to put Henry on the spot. We have a timing issue. If the if the report to the governor is due April 1st, obviously we're making budget decisions way before the conclusion of that process. So I think we're going to have to sort of consider that as we go along. So so Henry and then Anna. Henry, you have anything to throw out here?
Sure. the police. I mean, I agree with what everything's been said. I also agree that people have talked about the community outreach worker program being expanded, about the, you know, lead being expanded. And so we have ideas. We just have to, you know, expand them if we want to go that direction. Mm-hmm. In terms of the budget, I mean, I would like to get the advice of the people who went through the 2008 budget, to figure out what you did back then, to hear about that. I'd also like to, and maybe this is just the harsh way of thinking about it, but I'd like from Jason to basically give us a formula. Give us a formula, basically, okay, we got a $7 to $13 million deficit. You know, how much is it worth? I mean, how much would we get by laying off people? How much would we get from other funding, other things? Basically, what's the moving pieces in that puzzle? Because, you know, we're going to have to face it sooner or later. If we want to put everything in fund balance, that's fine. But I assume he doesn't recommend that. I assume he obviously does not recommend that we tax everyone either. And so, again, just sort of the different ways that we can come up with money to balance it, because I do think that's going to be very important, because we're all going to have different priorities, but, you know, if we have a fiscal way of dealing with it, we can do it. And also, you know, Martha and Leslie and I already suggested having a public dealings with the budget, like Mike Lane has stated, saying going to the public to try to get buy-in, try to get their ideas. But what should our priorities be? Because I'm thinking about maybe, you know, putting your thing about a difficult budget. Yeah, maybe putting that on my listserv and see what people have to say about it. Just to sort of see, just to get their response. Because I already told them it's going to be a tough budget year. And so, you know, just finding out what they have to think and what their priorities are would be very important.
Thanks, Henry. And I'm going to go to the second page of it in a minute. Jason, do you want to respond to the question about, you know, give us a formula or anything that Henry said there, or anything any of us has said so far?
I mean, I think it's been helpful to hear what everybody's interests are. I think, you know, this is going to be a difficult balance. But the only thing I can assure you is, you know, we're going to spend a lot of time put together a fair and reasonable budget that's going to make sense. You know, there will be parts of it that you all like, and there will be parts of it that some of you won't. That's probably the best I can offer you right now. You know, we're going to take this one step at a time. Got good staff, good department heads that I think are going to come at this with some innovative ideas and thoughts. So I'm always surprised, and they show great leadership at times like this, a challenge. So we have to trust that they'll put together some good thoughts and bring forward some good things to us, and they will. So, you know, as far as a formula, there is no magic formula. You know, if there was, I wouldn't be sitting here right now. That formula was, you know, we'll put together an honest and a good, fair, reasonable budget, and we'll go from there. And that's all I can offer you.
Okay.
Thanks, Jason. Anna?
Yeah, I just wanted to request that that we have a discussion during this budget cycle of what we all mean by defund the police, because I don't know if everybody has the same definition of what that is. So it's important, I think, that we're all on the same page. And from what I have heard in support of what Leslin was saying, there's a reimagining that's being required at the state level, but there's also what I'm hearing by a majority of people in the discussions that I'm having is not disbanding, which is separate than defunding, a reevaluation of the components that are things that have been put onto our law enforcement that could actually be shifted into public health issues, that they're not actually fundamentally criminal issues, but public health issues. And the idea is to decrease the risk factors causing criminality at its core. So identifying the root causes, prioritizing investments in those to reduce the need itself, rather than simply prioritizing criminalization. So we may all be coming from different places, and I just want to make sure that we all have that same definition, working definition, when we have that conversation.
Yeah, I agree, and I think that'll be just a wild guess, a big topic of future agendas by the Public Safety Committee, and so I think that'll be really important. Before we close, I thought I would let me go through the next page here, and I would caution that, and this was just part of the rest of your what I sent in by email. I would caution that if we do decide to go out to the public, and I think it's a good idea, there's a lot of preparation involved in presenting anything that would have meaning to the public. Our budget is so complex. You don't want to just throw it out there. I mean, I remember the years when people would say, well, just do the things you have to do, like fix the roads and keep the library open. We'd say, well, actually, those are the things we don't have to do. So unless we take time to prepare a solid presentation, and that takes a lot of time to do that, to educate the public going in so that they can give us meaningful input back. It's a major piece of work to get that kind of presentation ready. So I think that's something that really Jason and his staff really have to think through. So I just to sort of go through the rest of the things that I had thrown in on a list, as we think about all the lines that we're going to look at, all the decisions we're going to have to make and that Jason and department heads are going to have to make, you know, is this program or staff role or project or contract, is it necessary? You know, do we have to do it? Is it effective and worthwhile? Another calculation, does it leverage other resources, whether, you know, that's partnership with other entities or is it something where we can bring outside money in if we do it, or lose money if we don't keep it up. Is anybody else doing this, providing this service? Is it unduplicated? Is this an investment that will save us money in the long run or avoid costs later on if we go ahead and put this money in? Is it consistent with my values? For example, if your value is helping people at risk or marginalized population. Does the community want us to do this? Will it help our staff to function more effectively and efficiently? I noticed Jason had some thoughts in there about ITS, and I think, and using technology to improve our effectiveness, very important. That's kind of invisible, frankly, to the public, but could be really critical. What would happen if we cut this program? You know, do we lose other resources? Is there anybody else to pick that service up? Could we pick it up later? You know, if we just delay an expenditure, is it something that really wouldn't hurt anything that much if we delay that expenditure? In some cases, would it cost us more in the long run if we cut? Is it penny wise and pound foolish to cut that? So another two questions, just can we afford to do this? Can we afford not to do this particular thing, whatever that thing is? So these are just some kind of ways I've over the years thought about particular budget decisions that we've made. And I'm sure you can add things to the list. And if you are interested in sharing this with Listserv, you can certainly add, subtract, modify, however you like, go for it, and, you know, let us all know what you get back. So with that, unless there are any questions or comments on that list, I can take this off the screen. So, Leslin.
Sorry, Martha, I don't have anything else.
When we get into other conversations, I'll have more. Not right now.
Okay. All righty. Just see a few things in the chat. Jason, we have the ability to manage a meeting with public comments via Zoom. That sounds great. And, of course, somebody says that we have a problem with people who don't have Internet. Absolutely, that's always the case. Maybe it's the sort of thing we work that Dominic can work with the media and see if we can get good coverage of whatever it is we're going to put out there. So sounds like more work ahead. Is there anything else anybody would like to share or ask or any brand new ideas? All right. Well, again, thanks to everybody for all your hard work on this, for your thinking. And as we've said, this is just the beginning, or maybe it's the middle of the beginning. And Jason, thanks to you've got your hand up, Jason. We are
yes.
really grateful for all your work in putting this together and helping us think through these hard choices. Go ahead.
Thanks. I just wanted to add, and maybe this isn't the right time to talk about it, but you know, if we're talking about additional meetings, perhaps maybe a conversation about the EBC meetings and how they can be structured or structured differently. When you look at a calendar, you're talking about 2 to 4 night meetings a week for 8 weeks straight. And if there's an opportunity to have a conversation about perhaps condensing them into a 1 or 2 day session somehow versus 8 separate meetings in addition to legislature meetings, in addition to public info meetings, to kind of know that I'd like to be part of that conversation, only because it will get very difficult the past 4 months preparing the budget over the next 2 months and then going into 8 straight weeks of 3 night meetings a week is very difficult.
I would agree entirely. So yeah, the budget committee will tackle and certainly want to hear from you on that.
Okay. Thank you.
You stimulated some hands up. Mike Lane and then Henry.
I would disagree strongly. Some of us, and I realize it's not a majority, but some of us actually have jobs that we have to do. And to say let's take 2 or 3 days and spend it on budget may sound good, but it's pretty difficult. We talked about it last year. We didn't go forward with that idea, and I'd really think that the process we have, even though it may take several nights, as you've said, Jason, I think that's a better way of doing it. Thanks.
Henry?
Jason, I'm wondering, when do we need to sign off a deal with the amendments to the 2020 budget?
I'm not sure I understand what you're referring. Are you referring to something specific, or?
Well, we're going to be in a deficit. We're in a deficit situation. When do we have to adjust that budget? I know that 2021 will go through September, get it done by November. When do we have to adjust the budget or change things for the 2020 budget?
You generally wouldn't do a mid-year adjustment in this sense, meaning, you know, would you create fund balance to offset revenue? You generally wouldn't. In this case, you would run an operating deficit, and then at the year end, that operating deficit would negatively impact fund balance. It's generally how a situation like this would work. You know, a one-off expense where you usually expect to overexpend a budget line is usually done through a contingency transfer. In this case, with a revenue shortfall like this, you generally wouldn't amend the budget again until year end, which would be done at the end of the year, but you wouldn't generally take an action to adjust revenue.
Okay. Also, have you heard from anywhere in the Albany about them basically whatever stimulus that we get, if we get anything, of the state government sort of saying, fine, well, we can just cut your state aid by that amount?
I would expect it. I mean, that's how the last stimulus worked, 10 years ago, is it went to offset state projects, and, you didn't really get a lot of the trickle down. So I think it'll be a game, similar to all the effort that was put into the EFMAP funding, this last CARES Act, where it wanted to be, there was specific language that Senator Schumer worked on to ensure that it went to counties, primarily for this reason, and it slightly infuriated the governor. For the time being, I would expect that there'll be a similar game again played should this become a real discussion about a forced stimulus and ensuring that local aid goes to local municipalities and that they can't be negatively impacted by states. But
okay, it'll be thanks.
Part of the game.
Yeah.
Well, that does just, it's a nice segue, Henry, to the next. Now, tomorrow's meeting at 11:30. Continue the conversation. All right. Well, much more to come. Thank you all very much. Again, Jason, hope you have a great rest of the week and do get some time off. And everybody, have a good week and a good evening. Take care. Thanks for
Thank you. Good night.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Thank you.